It is a hot, sunny day in eastern Africa, and a pack of ancient lions is on the prowl. They all have their eyes on a herd of elephants, spotting one member that has fallen behind. The giant prey has not detected its stalkers, indeed the big cats approach in near silence, concealed by the long grass and shadows of trees. But after zeroing in on their target all at once, the lions tear off after the herd, leaping on to the unfortunate straggler and plunging their teeth into the elephant's leathery skin as the rest of its herd thunders off. Once their prey has died, the lions waste no time tearing into its flesh. They eat quickly, messily. Soon, vultures approach and begin circling overhead. Now sated, the killers run off, and as they leave the carcass behind, the vultures swoop down, settling in for a feast. One descends and perches on the dead elephant's tusk. But these vultures are not the only scavengers on the savannah. For from behind the trees, a group of small figures emerge. They are somewhat ape-like, but they walk on two legs. They bear an uncanny resemblance to humans, but they're not quite like anything you or I have ever seen. Indeed, standing tall, they'd only be waist or shoulder high on most of us. These not quite human-looking creatures, living in the African savannah roughly 2.5 million years ago, are our ancestors, and they are ready for a meal. Carrying sharp-edged pieces of stone, they descend on the carcass. Even fallen, the dead elephant towers over them. They hoist themselves onto its body, which is still warm under their feet. Squatting on the carcass, they cut away at the exposed meat with their flaked stone tools. The meat is tough and slippery between their teeth, but they work at it until they've broken it down enough to swallow, before working free their next piece. Eventually, their stone tools strike bone, but they don't stop here. Now they use their stones to pound at the bone until it breaks open, and then take turns slurping up its rich, fatty marrow. But what to these ancient creatures is just a hearty meal, is to us a turning point in history. For tens of millions of years, ever since the asteroid strike that wiped out most of the dinosaurs, our primate ancestors and relatives ate a diet consisting mainly of fruits, leaves, insects, and perhaps the occasional small animal. But at this moment, on the cusp of the Stone Age, our ancestors started scavenging. And as their diets changed, so did they, along with every species that descended from them. On a chilly day in early spring, a spotted salamander lays a group of eggs in a small pool of standing water on a leafy forest floor. The clump of eggs is encased in a thick layer of protective jelly, but the jelly does not keep everything out. Soon, algae will invade the egg capsules where the embryos are developing. They will nestle into the cells of the embryos themselves. And yet, these invaders are lifesavers. As each salamander embryo floats in the shallow water, the algae in its cells will harness energy from the sun and produce a constant flow of oxygen to the embryo. In exchange, the embryo releases carbon dioxide as waste, and the algae takes it in as fuel for photosynthesis. Together with the sunlight that permeates the jelly, embryos and algae produce a self-sustaining ecosystem, nourishing each other in this sealed-off world. A rare example of an animal that uses photosynthesis to grow and develop. Every organism, whether or not it eats in the way we think of as eating, needs nourishment. And across the animal kingdom, creatures have evolved all sorts of creative ways to get it. Herbivores, like deer and pandas, get nutrients from fibrous leaves, grasses, or other plants. Carnivores, like foxes and lions, hunt or scavenge meat. We humans do a bit of both, making us omnivores. But not everything has a diet of plants or meat or some combination of the two. Throughout the American tropics, leafcutter ants in forest canopies live up to their name by snipping small pieces of foliage with their jaws and loading them onto their backs. Once their cargo is in place, each ant merges into a column of hundreds, headed for their underground nest. But for all the work they've put into this harvest, these ants aren't your average herbivore, and they won't eat their bounty. Instead, they will look after the leaf clippings until tufts of white fungus sprout from them, and they will dine on this. These odd little farmers are fungivores, subsisting entirely on the fungus they cultivate in their gardens. Indeed, even microorganisms have to eat, and they have their own ways of nourishing themselves, sometimes in some of Earth's most inhospitable environments. Yet while a good meal means something different to every species, we all need some form of it. Carbohydrates are the quickest way to supply energy to the human body. Simple carbohydrates, such as the sugars in fruit or honey, are faster than complex carbohydrates, like starches and grains, but both are quicker than fats. If a surplus is consumed, our bodies store some of this as glycogen within our cells and converts the rest to fat. Fats, composed of fatty acids or glycerol, are the slowest source of energy, but the most energy-efficient food per gram, offering more than twice the energy of carbohydrates and proteins. And it's for this reason that the human body stores excess energy as fat. Proteins, however, are complex molecules, made of formations of amino acids that are not usually used for energy. Instead, they are vital to maintain and replace tissues. But before any kind of food can become fuel, the body first has to break it down, or digest it, to release the energy stored in its molecules' chemical bonds. Enzymes in our blood break down complex carbohydrates into simple sugars, proteins into amino acids, and fats into fatty acids. Only then can this fuel even enter our cells. But this energy doesn't get put right to use, because our bodies depend on stores of energy that they can tap into as needed. Instead, the released energy gets trapped in other molecules, like adenosine triphosphate, better known as ATP. And ATP is not just for animals like us, with bodies made of many cells. When a bacterium at the bottom of the ocean takes in nitrogen compounds, it breaks them down to release energy and forms ATP too. But it's not just these carbohydrates, proteins, and fats that our bodies depend on. They also need smaller amounts of nutrients like iron, vitamins, and iodine to regulate chemical activities like brain activity, digestion, and hormone regulation. And so, in spite of the wide-ranging diets of life on Earth, on a basic level, our bodies all run on pretty similar ingredients. So if we living things have fundamentally similar needs, why the different diets? As unappetizing as a dead fish or a dung ball sounds to us, for some animals, these are not just desperate choices, but rather dietary preferences, or even requirements. So why does any animal eat what it eats? Ultimately, all living things have to balance a few important needs. The first order of business is to consume enough energy to fuel our bodies. Blue whales are some of the largest creatures on Earth, with some adults growing to about the length of a basketball court. These giants require a colossal amount of food each day, and yet their meal of choice is an odd one. They get almost every single calorie from krill, minuscule crustaceans that float in patches in the ocean. A tiny creature averaging a couple of centimeters in length might seem like an odd meal choice for what may be the largest animal to ever live on Earth. But whales eat krill for a good reason. Krill are at the bottom of the food chain, and that means they're packed with energy. We humans can afford to be a little less efficient. Our broad diets come from many different points in the food chain, but on average, across the globe, humans' diets are a little over two levels removed from the bottom. And when it comes to meeting our energy needs, we are also all constrained by our biology and the environment where we find ourselves. Millions of years ago, before the invention of tools, our ancestors used their hands to get food. Despite their dexterous fingers adept at grabbing branches and plucking fruits, their hands were of little use for cutting into an animal or tearing flesh. Given these constraints, they gravitated towards a diet of mostly fruits, vegetables, and other easy-to-pick foods that were easy to both find and consume. As well as this, our teeth over time have become not exactly suited to catching and killing prey. Most carnivores possess large canine teeth. Some, such as cougars, can even use these to penetrate between vertebrae and sever the spinal cord of their prey. But one of the key characteristics of the hominin family, our family, are small canines. Just as hominins are the bipedal apes, so too are they the small canine apes. Yet whether we can find and consume something is only useful if our bodies can process it. And evolution has outfitted animals with countless different systems for digesting food. One of the most striking ones belongs to snakes. These animals don't have teeth that can chew, but that doesn't discourage a python from gulping up a whole deer. As soon as the python swallows its prey, its digestive system switches into high gear, secreting acid and enzymes that get to work breaking apart the meal. Meanwhile, some creatures that have no teeth have evolved resourceful techniques for mechanically crushing their food. Birds and earthworms both have an organ in their digestive tract called a gizzard. As they eat, small stones collect in the gizzard, which contracts to grind the stones against each other and crush any food that is passing through. Of course, we humans have a whole suite of tools for digesting the wide range of foods we eat. We have teeth and chewing muscles that can tear, crush, and shear our food. We have saliva in our mouths and acid in our stomachs that help break down chewed food. Indeed, saliva contains an enzyme called amylase that can break down starches, and lingual lipase, which breaks down fats. And our stomach acid is unusually strong, which helps prevent food poisoning. On top of this, we have a digestive tract full of hundreds of species of bacteria that help break down food and fight off pathogens that might be in it. The size of animals' bodies and certain body parts can also lend their own insights into their diets. Insectivores, for example, tend to be smaller than carnivores that eat larger prey. After all, the more energy you're getting from your food, the bigger you can be. But while meat-eaters' bodies have more freedom to grow, their gut area tends to be smaller than that of non-carnivores, thanks to the efficiency of eating meat. More concentrated sources of protein, like meat and insects, take less work to digest. So carnivores' digestive machinery can be simpler than that of a herbivore processing fibrous vegetation every day. Gorillas, whose diet mainly consists of leaves and shoots, have stomachs that can hold 4 to 20% of their body weight, whereas for humans, with our more varied diets, it's barely 1%. Ultimately, we are limited by what our bodies can process and how they extract energy from the things we consume. And these diets define us. In more ways than one, we are all what we eat. Not least because our digestive system transforms some of the food we eat into the raw materials our bodies are actually made of. Like all living things, we humans are made up of lots of carbon. But not all carbon atoms are the same. The ones that come from corn and sugarcane are ever so slightly heavier than the ones that come from leaves and grains. A look at your hair under the microscope can reveal how much of each kind of carbon you have in you, which can in turn expose your diet and even hint at where you likely live. More than half the carbon in an average American, for instance, comes from corn via corn-fed animals. But the notion that we are what we eat is also true in another, perhaps more important sense. For all of evolution, there has been a give and take between what's eaten and what is doing the eating. As species started eating new things, their bodies adjusted to those diets. So what we eat, in particular what our ancestors ate over millions of years, has literally made us what we are. And the story of our ancestors' diet is not a simple one. In 1899, a quarry worker uncovered a bewildering fossil deep in the mountains of Russia. At first glance, it resembled the spiral-shaped shells that housed the ancestors of today's octopus and squid hundreds of millions of years ago. But the edges were serrated like a buzzsaw, and a closer look revealed that this peculiar fossil was the remains of teeth, belonging to an ancient relative of sharks. The fish, which had roamed the seas some 270 million years ago, was named Helicoprion, and for over a century, paleontologists debated how these teeth had fit into their owner's mouth and how they worked. Some hypotheses placed the spiral teeth on the snout, others on the back, others deep in the throat. Many models later, scientists now believe that the whorl of teeth sat in the creature's lower jaw and rotated back and forth as the jaws moved, slicing and tearing prey while pulling them towards the throat. The shape and mechanics of this unusual set of teeth not only clarified our picture of this ancient creature, they also offered some clues into what this odd fish ate. Researchers reasoned that hard-shelled prey would have slipped off its curved teeth, and that it more likely ate soft prey that it could easily slice into pieces, like squid or soft-bodied fish. And so, as unusual as Helicoprion's teeth are, their usefulness for reconstructing the diet of an ancient creature is not unique. Today, paleontologists rely heavily on fossilized teeth to piece together the diets of animals that are long gone from the Earth, well after most other clues have disappeared. The clues from teeth come in several different forms. One way that diet manifests on a fossilized tooth is in the way it has been worn down. It takes different kinds of chewing to break down different kinds of food. Chewing flat, fibrous plant parts involves a great deal of shearing, while rounder items like berries, seeds, and insects can easily be crushed between molars. Over time, these repetitive motions erode microscopic patterns into the teeth that paleontologists can decipher millions of years later to figure out how an ancient animal chewed, which in turn hints at what it ate. The shapes of fossilized teeth offer similar clues. Leaf-eating animals, whose chewing involved more shearing, typically evolved longer crests on their molars. Meanwhile, insect-eating animals often had sharp points on their molars that allowed them to puncture or slice into insects' bodies. Beyond the individual teeth, the jaw itself holds another piece of the puzzle. Paleontologists can use its structure to infer how it once moved. For example, the spot where the lower jaw attaches to the skull can indicate its range of motion and the strength of its bite. In general, each of these methods offers a window into an animal's dietary habits or helps constrain what it might have eaten. But used together, methods like these can help paleontologists construct a detailed picture of the diet of ancient creatures, including our distant ancestors. And so, with these techniques in hand, we are now equipped to ask, what did our ancient ancestors eat? All around the planet, dust from a catastrophic asteroid strike is still floating in the atmosphere, dimming the sun. The animals that dominated the Earth for tens of millions of years are dying off in droves. It is 65 million years ago, and the Cretaceous has come to an end. And yet, as the old webs of life on Earth unravel, it is a time of new beginnings. The surviving life is blossoming into a wide array of new forms. Small mammals that have survived the devastation are scurrying through forests, plucking insects out of trees for food. These are placental mammals, the first animals to give birth to fairly developed offspring. They are our ancient ancestors, and not long after the dust settles, a relatively new lineage emerges from among them, a primitive form of primates. These early primates don't bear much of a family resemblance to anything we call a primate today. They are small, furry tree dwellers. The oldest one found in the fossil record is a chipmunk-sized creature known as Purgatorius. Like us and most other modern primates, scientists believe Purgatorius was an omnivore, able to process a wide range of foods. Insects were plentiful at this point in history, not to mention a good source of protein and vitamins, and they appear to be a centerpiece of Purgatorius's diet. Our distant relative also likely ate a great deal of fruit. For unlike some other early placentals, Purgatorius had teeth that were adapted for crushing soft foods, like fruit. The sharp, insect-piercing molars that characterized the teeth of other insectivore mammals had rounded out a bit, suggesting that insects were becoming less important to Purgatorius. It's not clear what exactly drove this particular change. Primates have always been flexible eaters, often able to make meals out of whatever kind of food is available in their habitat. And as finding food in the trees became increasingly important to early primates like Purgatorius, they evolved to get better at finding it. Their hands got better at grasping branches and plucking fruit, allowing them to navigate their treetop habitat with ease. Their eyes evolved to face forwards rather than to either side, giving them binocular vision, which enhanced their depth perception. Color vision also improved, enabling these primates to move swiftly through the forest and spot a ripe snack on the go. Meanwhile, their cognitive skills improved to meet the challenge of finding ripe fruit in a complex environment. It was becoming increasingly important to remember what was edible and where to find it, and as primates grew sharper, their brains grew larger. By the dawn of the Eocene, 56 million years ago, the planet was warming, and thick forests were blossoming across the continents. Amid this changing world, primates thrived, spreading around the globe and evolving into new forms. They were still tiny compared to today's primates, but some were gradually getting bigger. Our ancestors belonged to a group of primates called anthropoids that lived in Africa and parts of Asia. These would later branch into monkeys, apes, and humans, but then they were still fairly small, furry tree dwellers. Judging by their teeth, they continued to eat a broad diet of mostly soft foods, like ripe fruits, gums, and leaves, along with insects. Some anthropoid teeth from this era are spotted with cavities, supporting the idea that they ate a diet full of sugary foods like ripe fruits. Anthropoid fossils from the Eocene also have very few chipped teeth, indicating that these primates were not eating many hard foods like nuts or seeds. And with time, their diet shifted, perhaps in response to what was easiest to come by in their environment. Most anthropoids gradually went from favoring insects to favoring fruits and leaves. By the time the Eocene was giving way to the Oligocene, amid a wave of global cooling around 34 million years ago, these miniature anthropoids were growing larger. With bigger bodies to fuel, they started incorporating new foods into their diets, such as unripe fruits, nuts, and leaves. Their jaws grew stronger and more stable, perhaps as an adaptation to these new food sources. Their bodies were changing in more subtle ways too. Natural selection fine-tuned their senses to help them pick out edible items based on features like texture, color, and smell. And so for millions of years, our ancestors ate and evolved. Some 23 million years ago, Earth entered another warm period as it ushered in the Miocene. Apes had emerged in Africa, Asia, and Europe, and by now, the resemblance to modern-day apes was definitely there. For now, fruit still made up the bulk of their diet, but subtle changes in their teeth signal that a dietary change was underway in some of these apes. Their enamel was getting thicker, possibly giving them an advantage for chewing harder, more abrasive food, like seeds. Some might have begun eating harder, less ripe fruits. And this mixed diet may have reflected changes in the environment. Temperatures eventually cooled again, possibly making fruit a more seasonal offering. This lack of ripe fruits during off-season months might have driven apes to seek out new food. These ecological changes might also have shifted the balance between competitors and food sources, forcing apes to diversify their diets. And all the while, cognitive skills, like learning and memory, continued to be important as our ancestors foraged across broad, diverse habitats, where the availability of fruit varied. Evolution continued to favor these traits, along with the fine motor control it took to forage and consume fruit. By this point, many primates bore little resemblance to the shrew-like creatures they descended from, but their diets had not vastly changed. Overall, for millions of years, our ancestors subsisted on a mixed diet of mostly fruit, leaves, and insects. But that was going to change. On a lakeshore in what is now Central Europe, a thrum of insect song fills the air. The hot sun fills the sky, and birds soar over the glassy water, scanning the lake for fish. And in a small clearing, a group of hominins is squatting on the ground, using the sharp edge of a flaked stone to shave down slender branches they've pulled from a spruce tree. They predate modern humans by a few hundred thousand years, but they look and move like you or I. Working with intense focus, they shave a gentle arch into their stick and then sharpen its two ends to a point. A pile of shavings growing beneath them, they are building up their arsenal for their next hunt. As they work, two birds fly overhead, preoccupied with their own hunt, ignoring them for the most part. They have no idea that the natural order is shifting. Soon, not even the air will be safe. Hominins, just like the ones now patiently shaving down sticks, will soon be hurling these makeshift weapons at them, aiming to pluck them out of the air so they can feast on their warm bodies. But this pivotal development in our ancestors' diets was still far off when the first hominins emerged in Africa some 7 million years ago. This branch of primates, hominins, includes humans and all our living and extinct relatives. The earliest ones were still relatively small-brained, but they walked on 2 feet, like us, although for the first few million years they were still adapted for life in the trees. These archaic hominins emerged during yet another time of change on our planet. The lush African forests they'd been living in for generations were thinning out, giving way to sparse trees and grasslands. Familiar food sources dwindled as the trees receded, forcing our ancestors to seek out new forms of sustenance. Some of these turned to hard foods, like nuts, seeds, and tough plant roots, and their anatomy reflects this change in diet. They evolved massive jaws and large teeth with thick enamel that were up to the task of processing foods that required forceful crushing or grinding. Paranthropus boisei, or Nutcracker Man, a famous example from about 2 million years ago. Though some of their cousins retained more slender features and seemed to have stuck mostly to softer foods, such as fruit and leaves. Despite these differences, these archaic hominins were all omnivores that likely survived on whatever foods were available, including fruits, leaves, insects, eggs, and even small animals that they could catch and eat with their hands. But it was at this point our ancestors were about to arrive at a pivotal juncture in their evolutionary journey. They began making tools out of stones. In the vast arid plains of modern-day Tanzania, a canyon cuts across the land, nearly 50 kilometers long and 90 meters deep. The Olduvai Gorge. The region it cuts through has been home to our ancestors for millions of years. It saw hominins come down from the trees and take up walking on 2 feet. It saw the thinning of forests and the arrival of grazing herds. And it also witnessed one of the most revolutionary changes among our species. And we know this all thanks to this very gorge, slicing through the Great Rift Valley, where the African continental plate is in the slow process of splitting in two. As water carved out this gorge over thousands of years, it exposed layers of rock dating back millions of years, now sitting on top of each other like pages in a book. Since the 1950s, archaeologists and paleontologists have been coming to this site to explore what is in those pages, each one containing a different chapter in human history. They are rich with fossils of our ancient ancestors, and their stone tools. And it is here that in 1981, researchers discovered fossilized animal bones bearing some unusual scars. These were not the dull bite marks of a predator, but rather thin, straight lines. These lines had been made by the sharp edges of stone tools, wielded by some of our species' early butchers some 1.8 million years ago. In the 1990s, similar markings appeared in various sites in Ethiopia dating back even further, to some 2.5 million years ago. The shape and pattern of these butchery lines showed that our ancestors were using stone tools to carve meat off bones, and to break bones open for marrow. And this practice may date back much further. More recently, bones with possible butchery marks have been dated back to over 3 million years. but researchers are still debating whether or not these oldest marks were truly made by hominins. And so with this timeline still in question, it's not yet clear which of our forebears first started butchering large animals. It might have been our ancient relative called Australopithecus, or a member of one of the Homo lineages. What is clear is that at this point, there was no going back. It was the beginning of the Stone Age. These new tools let their owners access new foods. These hominins could pound and slice fruits and vegetables, making tough plant parts easier to digest. But these weren't the only new foods they were pursuing. With their woodland environment now transformed into more open land, large herds of grazing animals had begun moving through their habitat. And for the first time in history, our ancestors would start to see these large animals as food. Of course, 3 million years ago, our ancestors could not yet topple a large animal themselves. Indeed, it would be a long while before the first hunting tools appeared in the fossil record. But they had learned how to get at the precious calories in these large animals' flesh and bones. They bashed open animals' skulls to get at the fat in their brains, hammered open leg bones to suck out the fatty marrow, and carved off the muscles for protein. Lacking hunting skills of their own, they became masters of scavenging. How exactly they scavenged is still up for debate. Some of these hominins may have lain in wait, watching as hyenas or saber-toothed cats had their fill of a hippo or wildebeest, and then going in for the leftovers. But there is evidence that at least some of these early scavengers were more aggressive. Butchery marks reveal that our ancestors were often eating the heartiest part of the animal, suggesting that they weren't just raiding the leftovers. Perhaps some of these early scavengers hadn't waited their turn at all, but rather charged the scene with rocks and sticks, scaring predators away from their own kill and staking their claim to the meal. As unpalatable as it seems to us, raw meat in itself wasn't a dramatic change for our ancestors, who'd likely been eating small animals raw for millions of years, at least occasionally. But over time, their bodies adapted to a diet that included scavenged meat. Their jaws grew more suited to biting and tearing, and their teeth shrank as they increasingly outsourced food processing to their crude tools. Meanwhile, their guts shrank in tandem as they began to depend more on meat, which gave them more energy for much less digestive work. Over millions of years, our ancestors lost their adaptations for life in the trees. They now relied fully on food that they could find on the ground. And by 500,000 years ago, some of them, possibly Homo erectus, took up hunting as a way to meet that need. The first hunters may have taken down their prey with thrusting spears carved out of tree branches. It was a dangerous method that required them to attack their prey from up close. But over time, they developed savvier weapons, including throwing spears that allowed them to assail their prey from a safe distance. And so as they mastered hunting, they evolved from opportunistic scavengers to ruthless predators who were selective about what they killed. Fossil remains of hunted animals reveal that their hunters increasingly sought out adult males, seeking to maximize their gains from the effort it took to hunt. Exactly how important at this point meat was to our ancestors is still debated. It's clear that they continued to eat a wide variety of foods, but their diets morphed as they began to eat more meat, and once again, so did their bodies. To begin with, their guts steadily shrank as their diets incorporated more meat. A smaller gut meant our ancestors could no longer process the high volumes of tough plant material that they'd eaten for millennia. Instead, they relied on calorie-rich foods that were easier to digest. Large animals took great effort to hunt, but they offered great reward for the energy expended. And all the while, as hominins' bodies adapted to their shifting diets, traces of their evolutionary journey remained written in their genes, and still remain in ours. Thanks to our insectivore ancestors, we retain genes encoding enzymes for breaking down insects. We have acidic stomachs that more closely resemble the stomachs of scavengers than those of our vegetarian cousins. Acidity can help kill pathogens in decaying meat, suggesting that our stomach chemistry may be a vestige of the days when our ancestors dined on carrion. Today, the human digestive system resembles an old factory, stocked with machinery that's been retrofitted across deep time to process new forms of sustenance. So what can all this history tell us about what we evolved to eat, or indeed, what we should eat today? The answer depends greatly on who you ask, but perhaps the greatest insight we can glean from our ancestors is that our bodies did not evolve around one specific diet. They evolved to thrive on whatever was around. For all the changes our ancestors have been through since dinosaurs walked the earth, they have remained flexible eaters that thrive not on one specific diet, but on variety. When early primates were still subsisting on fruit and insects, they likely still snacked on the occasional small animal or egg. Even when our ancestors began scavenging and hunting meat, they never stopped eating plants. And so, this is the legacy we have inherited. We are omnivores, as our ancestors have been for tens of millions of years. And even among omnivores, we have a remarkably broad diet. There are very few animals on this planet that could eat a cow, or a shrimp, or a peach, or a salad. Like all living things, we need a balance of nutrients, but we can get them from many places, as our ancestors have shown us, time and time again. But this story of our evolution from shrew-sized insect eaters to spear-wielding hominins is not yet complete. In the years since our hominin ancestors began scavenging hippo and eating large quantities of meat, our dietary history has taken at least two more major turns. And our bodies have done the same. In 1989, Israel suffered a drought. This caused water levels to drop dramatically in the Sea of Galilee, and as well as the mud and slime, the receding shoreline revealed something else. Something spectacular. An ancient human camp belonging to a prehistoric band of hunter-gatherers who had lived some 23,000 years ago. The small settlement was made up of six brush huts, several long-extinguished hearths, and a lone grave holding the skeleton of a man. Hardened silt in the lake bed had sealed off the site in low oxygen conditions, leaving the whole settlement exquisitely preserved. And amid all this, archaeologists uncovered something perhaps even more remarkable: the charred remains of ancient plants, including some ancestors of today's weeds. While few people nowadays would celebrate the discovery of a weed, the presence of these pesky plants was a telltale archaeological clue. Weeds thrive in environments disturbed by human activity, having evolved to tolerate altered soils, suck up water voraciously, and spread prolifically. That meant that these ancient proto-weeds hinted at something astonishing. They suggested that people had been disturbing the soil and cultivating plants 23,000 years ago, long before the onset of agriculture. And as staggering an idea as it is, other objects in the site reinforce this hypothesis. A stone sickle with clear patterns of wear strongly suggests it had been used for harvesting wild cereals, like wheat, oat, and barley. The site also contained a crude grinding slab, surrounded by fossilized grain parts that the inhabitants would have used to grind down their harvest. As well as this, fossil evidence shows that the inhabitants of the site had been able to live at this camp year-round, dependent on foods that they cultivated for themselves. Remarkably, this early foray into agriculture predated the first large-scale agricultural societies by some 11,000 years. And though this way of life would not last, generations of hunter-gatherers would follow, it was an early trial of a lifestyle that would eventually change the course of the human diet and evolution forever. Returning to Africa more than a million years ago, as our earlier hominin ancestors crafted tools and coordinated elaborate scavenging and hunting missions, they were still hundreds of thousands of years away from developing the cognitive skills that it would take to plan, manage, and exploit an agricultural site for food. And so how did these remarkable scavengers make the leap to the organized farmers of today? Over generations, they evolved slowly. Their bodies got bigger, and little by little, so did their brains. Then, just under a million years ago, our ancestors underwent a dramatic change captured in the fossil record. Their brains jumped in size, while their bodies stayed about the same. Paleontologists had long linked this expansion in brain size to the beginning of a meat-based diet. They hypothesized that eating meat, which is relatively simple to digest, had freed up some of the energy that had once been needed to power the digestive system, allowing our guts to get smaller. At the same time, bigger brains were becoming more important for communicating and coordinating activities like hunting and scavenging, introducing a selective pressure in favor of bigger brains. This is called the expensive tissue hypothesis. Since brains and guts both demand a great deal of energy, a trade-off between gut and brain size made sense mathematically. However, the fossil record hasn't held up this story. Our ancestors have been eating meat since around 3 million years ago. And although brain sizes were slowly increasing, the big jump only happened within the last million years. So if not meat consumption, what was it that drove this immense jump in brain size? It's a question scientists still debate, but one possible explanation is fire. Deep in a cave in the hills of South Africa, archaeologists have uncovered burnt bones and plant ashes dating back 1 million years, when pre-modern hominins lived throughout this region. The existence of this burnt material so deep in the cave suggests that it wasn't the work of some stray flames from a wildfire, but rather manipulated by early humans, possibly Homo erectus. If these hominins had learned to control fire by 1 million years ago and begun using it to cook their food, this could have had a drastic impact on our evolution, because cooking food doesn't just make it taste better, it also lets us get more energy out of it. Heat from fire helps prepare food for digestion by breaking down starches and proteins into smaller bits that are easier for our body to absorb. It also breaks down the molecules that tend to encase fats, freeing these nutrients as well. Indeed, long before humans began cooking food, they'd been outsourcing some of their digestion to processes outside their body. Even simple processes like slicing and pounding food reduce demands on digestive systems, freeing up energy for other processes. And cooking takes things one step further, allowing our bodies to do less work, even as they extract more energy from the same amount of food. And this was potentially crucial, because our brains require a colossal amount of food. Despite only taking up 2% of our body mass, the modern human brain takes up around 20% of our body's energy, even if we're doing nothing but daydreaming. Our ancestors' brains would not yet have been so large, but they would still have required an extraordinary amount of energy. And cooked food could explain where that extra energy came from. However, not all researchers agree that the evolution of our big brains was driven by the advent of cooking and the energy it redirected from digestive duties. Some doubt whether our smaller-brained forebears were up to the task of building and managing fire. Others argue that the jump in brain size would have happened regardless of whether or not they were cooking food. But regardless of the role it played in jump-starting the growth of our big brains, cooking food as a way of pre-digesting our meals has undoubtedly allowed us to reap greater rewards from what we eat and shifted the way our body spends its energy. It's a reminder that, on some level, processed food is part of our evolutionary heritage. Processing food to some degree outside our bodies is what eased the load on our digestive systems, allowing our bodies to devote resources to other systems and evolve the way they did. And these shifts set the stage for the next major change in our long dietary history. Between 200 and 300,000 years ago, the changing climate once again had our ancestors on the move. Various groups of hominins were migrating to new homes and intermingling with each other as they settled into new regions all over the African continent. And by 200,000 years ago, modern humans had emerged from the mix. For tens of thousands of years, Homo sapiens lived in migratory bands of hunter-gatherers that continued to forage and hunt for each meal. They spread outside the African continent to southern Asia, Australia, and eventually beyond. But then, 23,000 years ago, our ancestors, who had been foraging since the time of the dinosaurs, first started cultivating wild plants in the Levant. They settled in around their food sources and began staying in place for long periods of time. How exactly the rise of agriculture played out over the millennia that followed is an active topic of research and debate. Indeed, agriculture did not take off all at once, but evidence from various human settlements suggests that over the course of several thousand years, different bands of people who knew nothing of each other's existence began cultivating plants around roughly the same time in history. As for what triggered so many parallel attempts at agriculture around the same time, we can't know for sure, but some researchers have pointed to a link between this dramatic cultural change and a fluctuating climate. Changing climate would have altered the landscape, affecting the availability of traditional food sources, perhaps even pushing people towards agriculture as a way to ensure some food stability during changing times. But however it began, in the last 5,000 years, almost all humans have made the switch from hunting and gathering to some kind of farming. What had been small groups of nomads grew into larger, more complex communities that settled into villages. Before long, great civilizations went up in the Fertile Crescent, China, and the Americas. Farming became a way of life around the world. The onset of agriculture precipitated a huge change in how humans live, and it came with many consequences, both for better and for worse. As societies grew around centers of agriculture, close, crowded living conditions led to an increase in infectious diseases. Our bones got thinner as we traded kilometers of daily walking for a more sedentary lifestyle. And our jaws shrank as our bodies adapted to the relative ease of chewing cooked food, leaving many people with mouths overcrowded with teeth. But for all their downsides, these civilizations became centers of culture, where people shared ideas, knowledge, and traditions. Our entire modern way of life grew out of a change in how our ancestors acquired their food. And yet, even this, the rise of modern society, was not the end of the dance between our changing diet and evolution. In just the last few thousand years, small genetic differences emerged within our species as people around the globe adapted to the food available to them. And those differences persist. Today, the indigenous people of Greenland have adaptations for processing high amounts of fat, allowing them to subsist on a diet that has traditionally included many fatty animal foods, such as seals and whales. Meanwhile, people whose ancestors traditionally ate a high starch diet, such as Europeans, have special adaptations that allow them to process relatively high quantities of starches. And so, in the end, reconstructing the diets of our paleo ancestors can only tell us so much about how to feed our modern bodies, or indeed, what is natural for us to eat. If our early ancestors had continued to eat the way they did indefinitely, we simply wouldn't exist. Each change in diet set them on a new evolutionary path that eventually led to us. If early primates hadn't switched from eating mostly insects to eating mostly fruit, we might not have had our sharp vision or depth perception. If our hominin forebears hadn't had to seek out seasonal foods in a wide habitat, our memory and cognitive skills might not be what they are. If they hadn't started eating meat and cooked food, we might still be spending a quarter of the day chewing like our ape cousins, rather than using our energy for cognitive functions or anything else. and if modern humans hadn't started farming, we might not have plagues or high blood pressure, but we might also not have cities or the wide range of rich cultures we have today. Our dietary history is embedded in our genes, in the size of our guts and brains, and the shape of our jaws and teeth, but also in our societies, our culture, and perhaps in our ability to reflect on what we should eat at all. You've been watching The Entire History of Humankind. Don't forget to like and subscribe.